Hello and welcome to Beyond the Back Page on Near FM with myself, Patrick Donoghue. After winning the All-Ireland football final in 95 against Tyrone, Dublin would go a further 16 years without winning another All-Ireland. Neil Cotter has written a U-book about this time period entitled Dublin, the Chaos Years, and I'm delighted to be joined on the line by Neil. Neil, thanks very much, first of all, for joining us today.
No problem, Patrick. Nice talking to you.
So, Neil, I mentioned there the Dublin won that final in 95, but there was a sense with that team. They lost out in All-Ireland in 1992 and lost out again in 94. There was a sense that that team kind of fell over the line in 1995.
Yeah, very much so. You know, they didn't win as well, but I think as part of the interviews for the book, Tommy Carr, who would go on to manage Dublin and of course played in the early part of the 90s as well, he reckons in his view that the team was maxed probably 93-94, and at 1995 they were already over the hill at that point. Now a lot of the lads who were on that team in 95 and then played on for another few years after that would dispute that, I think, but that certainly seems to be the case. I think they were very, very lucky to win in 95. Having said all that, they could have easily had two All-Ireland under their belt at that point, but yeah, unfortunately they didn't.
Yeah, and because it was kind of a team that was older and a lot of mileage on the clock, it made it very, very hard in for the U-man coming in. So when Mickey Whelan took over, it was he found it very, very hard to kind of stamp his mark on that team.
He did, and you get that in any industry or any business or any kind of walk of life when you have lads who are so used to doing things a particular way,
yeah,
and then you have a new manager comes in or a new boss or whatever, and they come in and they try and stamp their authority on it and change things to a new way without explaining properly why this might be a good idea, whether you're going to have a lot of resistance to that change. So you had a lot of veteran players there who had been around in some cases since the late 80s,
yeah,
and they'd seen it all, you know, they'd been there and done that, and then Mickey came in and he kind of tried to inflict these new ways that he had learned over the course of his career, and you know, some people did not respond well to that.
Yeah, and in that Dublin team you had a lot of strong characters. Reading the book, one of the most colourful characters was Keith Barr, and he was kind of reluctant for when the U players came in. He wouldn't be the sort of player to kind of put an arm around their shoulder and, you know, welcome to the fold. He really felt you had to earn the call up.
Yeah, because the way Keith thought is that, you know, he'd earned his jersey through defeat. He had lost so many big games. He was kind of marked by defeat. Now, I always knew kind of as a fan that Keith Barr was a tough guy, but I think it was only until we did the interviews for this book that I realised, you know, how tough and single-minded he really was. He lost some big games, and he said himself, you know, when you lose a big game, it hardens you.
Yeah.
And when he kind of saw new guys coming into the team, he might have felt some of them mentally weren't up to scratch and some of them just weren't good enough players. And he wasn't slow to kind of make his feelings known, and it wasn't as if he didn't pick on people.
Yeah.
That wasn't his thing. He would ignore them.
Yeah.
And like you said, he wouldn't put the arm around the shoulder. But he did tend to have rows, but he tended to row it upwards. So he'd row with Tommy Carr, he'd probably row with Mickey Whelan.
Yeah.
And make his views known that way. He wasn't somebody who'd pick on weaker players, but he was someone who would ignore weaker players, I think.
Yeah, and the thing I really liked about the book, it was a great, at the moment, Dublin have such great success, but reading the book, it's a reminder for people that are younger that it wasn't always the way. And during that time period, like you mentioned, you talked to some of the players, like even within the dressing room, there was kind of divides between north side, south side players, and there was players from Kilmacud weren't seen as kind of tough enough or weren't seen as in a true Dubs. It was a kind of a totally different sort of dressing room than that you have now.
Yeah, like, but if you look at the team, I guess, that won in 2011, it was very much, there was a huge representation of Southside players, Kilmacud being one of those clubs. And back in, I was genuinely shocked to find out during research for this book that that divide existed. It just sounds ridiculous now that somebody could be treated less equal than somebody else because they came from Kilmacud Crokes. But that is the case. Kilmacud had only started to really break through and dominate Dublin club football at that point. So there was a little bit of a lingering distrust and suspicion and dislike for some of the Kilmacud players. And it's very much a real thing. Mm. It isn't imagined. I mean, anybody who was at Kilmacud at that time will tell you. And indeed, some of the people who weren't at Kilmacud and playing for some of the more established Northside clubs tell you the same thing as well.
Yeah. And Tommy Carr came in after Mickey Whelan left. And I suppose the credit for Tommy Carr, he didn't win a Leinster title while he was there, but he started to make the team a bit more united. So there was progression there under Tommy Carr.
Yeah, and I think if anyone's been super critical of Tommy Carr, they'll probably say that he could have achieved that in a shorter space of time. It did take him 4 years to do it. I think that's been super critical of him because he had an incredibly difficult job to do, and he was only 36 when he took the job, and that's kind of hard to believe now as well.
Yeah.
He didn't have any coaching or managerial experience in Gaelic football, the army background, but that was it. And he came into this dressing room, he played with so many of the lads, and it's not like he got on particularly well with a lot of them. Some of them he didn't get on well with. There was a bit of distrust, a bit of suspicion there. So he tried to work with what he had at the beginning. It didn't quite work out. In hindsight, he should have probably clipped a few wings much earlier, but of course that's probably easier said than done. I don't think there would have been too many managers who could have gone in to that dressing room and done the job that was required at that time. But in fairness to Tommy, he did have it turned around by the time he was let go in 2001.
Yeah, and it's kind of, reading your book, it's quite sad the way he left. He seemed to have the confidence of the county chairman, but it kind of disappeared. And I just thought it was sad because he said when he was talking to you that he didn't go, he kind of stepped away from Dublin for football for a decade. So it was kind of a sad way that his tenure ended.
Yeah, he said he never went to Croke Park to see Dublin play for 10 years afterwards. And but that's extraordinary for a guy who's been playing since 1984. And he finished up playing, I think it was in 1994, and then went on to manage. So he was always there, and he used to always organise his tours of Lebanon so that he could play for Dublin. So Dublin, you could say, was his life with the army. And then I guess he was so upset by how it all ended that you know, he couldn't deal with going to the games for so long afterwards. And indeed, it was even got to the point where when they made the breakthrough the following year that he wasn't exactly over the moon, which is hard. It's hard to explain that without making him look bitter or whatever. He wasn't bitter, but Dublin had won a Leinster, and I guess that's what he'd been striving for. But it was a real sickener, I guess, for him on one level to see them win when he wasn't involved, and he'd been involved in almost everything else, you know, up to that.
Yeah, and any at present, when you hear any debates about Dublin, there's always this, people talk about finances. But around the time when Dublin were in the doldrums, there were Bertie Hearn, who in some respects is much maligned in other circles, but he was a great great supporter of the Dublin GAA, and he really, really kind of helped in with Dublin GAA at this time period.
Yeah, he did. And one of the players said to me that without Bertie Ahern, GAA in Dublin will be dead. And that's one of the players saying, it's not Bertie saying it. He played a huge part. I mean, John Bailey as well, another fellow who's much maligned, and obviously Tommy Carr doesn't have too much time for John Bailey, but when he was chairman in the early part of the 90s, he basically conducted a survey of the club scene in Dublin, the club and the school scene in Dublin, and he saw that it was on its knees. And particularly in the schools, the traditional powerhouses were kind of dying out. Teachers weren't volunteering. And so while Dublin were getting to All-Ireland finals in 94, 95, behind the scenes, you know, a sense of decay had set in.
Yeah.
So I mean, he approached Bertie Ahern. He said, look, we're in trouble. What can we do here? And between the two of them, they got the money ring-fenced for Dublin GAA. And, of course, that's opened up a whole can of worms now further down the road. But I think it's generally accepted that had they not done that, I know certain clubs would have gone to the wall, without a doubt. And the clubs now, had this not been done, I don't know if it would be.
Yeah, it's remarkable that Dublin went 7 years without winning a Leinster title. When you think what's happening now, they're totally dominated. And it was Tommy Lyons who won that Leinster title. He was a manager that at the start he was seen as very, very positive. He was keen to give young players a chance, and the young players seemed to really, really warm to him.
Yeah, like if Tommy Lyons only did 1 year in charge of Dublin, he'd be considered, you know, one of the good managers of recent times, because that first year was it's hard to emphasize enough how important 2002 was, because they've been in the doldrums like 7 years is extraordinary now you think about it as well. But he came along 2002, he got these young players who would become the spine of the team for years to come. Barry Cahill, he brought Stephen Cluxton as his first chance or first choice, and David Henry and people like that, you know, youngsters, and he made them the core of the team. Now the most important thing was he got Ray Cosgrove back, he got Alan Brogan up into the corner forward, and he had Johnny McNally up there as well. It became a phenomenal full forward line in that year. They won Leinster. I just remember myself from being a supporter at the time how big a year it was. It was like an explosion of colour after years of just black and white. If he'd stepped away at the end of that year, he would have gone down as one of the greats, I think, just for delivering that Leinster.
Yeah, and the next manager that took up the reins after him was Pillar Caffrey, and it was quite a surprise, his appointment, because he was part of that backroom team, and he was seen someone as very, very quiet. But when he gave the first meeting, the players saw a totally different side of Pillar Caffrey then.
They did. I don't think anybody was too enthusiastic about Peter Caffrey when he got the job first, because anyone who played under him saw he was very much Tommy Lyons' assistant. You know, he was, I don't know if yes man is too harsh a word, but he certainly wasn't one who made his feelings particularly known. He was great at the defensive drills, and players would have known him as Tommy. That was it. And then the next thing, he was given the job after couple of other options fell through, and lads were like, I'm not sure about this. But in fairness to him, the first meeting that they had, I think it was in DCU, he blew them away. He really did blow them away with his talk and with his plans for the future, and everybody bought into him very quickly, and it became a very happy dressing room, a very productive kind of dressing room. And again, Pillar did some great things for Dublin as well. Leinster, they ended up winning Leinster, I think, every year under his watch. Things would kind of go into disarray after that, but he certainly played his part as well in the rejuvenation of Dublin football.
Yeah, and one of the things some people have criticised him for was he was keen to kind of get the supporters on board. So before the matches, he'd get the players to go in front of the hill just to kind of get that support going.
Yeah, and like, hindsight is 20/20 vision, but at the time he thought it would be the kind of jolt that they needed. And in fairness, everybody loved it.
Yeah.
The players liked it at the beginning. The supporters loved it because they were being included almost. It was like you were, without being too corny, it was like you were the 16th man. No one else has the resource that is Hill 16, in fairness. So no other county could buy into this type of thing. Dublin could, and Pillar said, right, because for Pillar it was about the inches, and if this was an extra inch that he could get to get us over the line, then great, we'll try it. And he tried it, he did, and it made for some of the best atmospheres I think Croke Park has ever seen. But in the end, did it perhaps get in the way of them making a breakthrough? It might have done. I don't think in hindsight it was the greatest idea in the world.
He was gone, and one of the piece and book, I found it quite sad, like after that heavy defeat against Tyrone, he just I think he said to his wife, "I just want to get out of here. I just want to get out of Dublin." So it is kind of sad, given how much he put in, that kind of his career, managerial career, and with Dublin ended like that.
What I tried to make a bit of a theme in the book was that, you know, it does end for everybody. And it's just a matter of how it ends. Yeah. Not everybody can go out like Alan Brogan, you know, and score a crucial point in the All-Ireland final against Kerry in the rain or whatever. Most people go very, very quietly or very, very reluctantly, or it's tinged with regret or tinged with sadness, and they're only human beings and they're putting everything into this cause, and then when it's over, it's over. So for Pillar, it ended on a horrible note. But it ends on a horrible note for lots of people too.
Yeah, and one thing that struck me reading the book was the culture was totally different. You mentioned the players would have, there was a lot more socialising, there was a lot more drinking. I think the Sunnybank was the place where the Dublin players would have drank a lot. Yeah. But it really, really was a totally different culture, and it's not that long ago. It's just remarkable.
It was, and it isn't long ago, but in fairness, it would have probably been the culture in a lot of places.
Yeah.
I know, say, Stephen O'Neill, for example, in Tyrone, was a committed teetotaler, and you know, but I think most people weren't, and let your hair down.
Yeah.
It's crazy when you think about it now, the team drinking with the fans in a hotel bar after every game. It just wouldn't happen today. Now, I know a lot of people miss that, but would they trade it off for what they have now? Probably not. They had some good times in the Sunnybank, that's for sure.
Pat Gilroy was the man that finally got Dublin that All-Ireland, but reading the book, it's remarkable what an impact he had. He was more than just the coach. He'd great insight. He kind of got that sponsorship deal with Vodafone. I think you make the point. He was more of a commercial manager. He was really, really a remarkable man who's probably the kind of catalyst for Dublin doing so well.
Yeah, he brought it all together.
Yeah.
And he was very fortunate to have Mickey Whelan as a coach, and it was a bit of redemption for Mickey Whelan as well. But while Mickey ran the coaching, Gilroy ran pretty much everything else. He somehow, we're in the middle of a horrible recession in 2011.
Yeah.
Country was on its knees. All the other counties were cutting back in their expenditure, but Dublin were actually increasing theirs. And that was down to Gilroy.
Yeah.
Who worked with John Costlow and did some astonishing work, just getting secondary sponsorship deals and all that sort of stuff. And as Bertie says in the book as well, you know, he needed the money to get the doctors and the physios and the weekends away and all that sort of stuff, and he got it. But it's not about the money. The money's important. The money helps facilitate what he wants to do. But they put the work on the pitch as well.
Yeah,
I don't have the figure in front of me here, but Alan Brogan wrote recently, it's not in the book, in response to a journalist who was speaking a lot about the money, that the number of days training that they did in 2011.
Yeah,
and I think it was 100 and something.
Yeah,
it was astonishing the amount of work they put in. Like, they were working morning and night.
Yeah,
So these lads were putting their life on hold as well. Now I know a lot of other counties. But the workload under Pillar Gilroy certainly increased from Pillar's day, and even Pillar's day was quite high.
Yeah, and like you mentioned in the book, did 6 a.m. sessions, and another bit I thought was very interesting that you mentioned when they went out the first year, he made sure that the players didn't kind of ease off, because he saw that as a problem with a lot of teams that get knocked out of the championship and let themselves go and they wouldn't start training. But he was keen to get them into the gym a couple of months after, so just to keep, so that to be prepared for the next year.
Yeah, like as we say, in whenever anyone who plays football, when they come back, it's always, did you winter well? And if you've got 3 or 4 months off, you know, you're probably going to go on the sauce and eat and enjoy your Christmas and all that sort of stuff. So strength and conditioning became, it's obviously you couldn't run a team now without proper strength and conditioning coaches and all that, but it was a couple of months, a year, you know, a decade ago, and Gilroy changed all that. It became a year-round thing, and that hasn't changed now under Jim Gavin. You know, it's not optional.
Yeah, and you would have been a supporter back in them that time period. Do you miss them days? Because, you know, the last couple of years, I know, I guess you loved them winning all them All-Irelands, but is there a sort of nostalgia for them days? Because there would have been good times. There was a lot of bad times, but it would have been good fun following Dublin back then.
Yeah, I miss the days, because I think Gaelic football, like any sport, is about competition. It's about not knowing who's going to win on the day. It's about, you know, the sort of cut and thrust that haven't been seen today. And I think the reason I wrote the book is I was standing on the hill, bored out of my mind during some Leinster match in 2016, and I was just saying, you know, it shouldn't be like this. Now, I'm not wishing this success away for a second, and I've had this conversation with more than enough people, but I would love a bit more competition. I would love for Leinster to go back to something like what it used to be, when you could have three different winners over three different seasons. And this isn't 100 years ago either. Leash, Westmeath and Dublin won it over three seasons earlier in the 2000s, and that's kind of what you want. You want, for the neutral, you want it to be a spectacle. I also miss the atmosphere that was generated under Pillar's time. I think if we're being honest with ourselves, it's not the same anymore. Yeah. We'll never have another 2011, but with each passing All-Ireland win, it gets a little bit more, maybe a little bit less. I don't know how to describe that. It's just, it hasn't been the same. Now, I'm not going to say I'd sit here and I'd want to swap better atmosphere for All-Ireland titles. Absolutely not. We're all enjoying this magnificent Dublin team as well. But a little part of you, misses the good old days.
Yeah. And before I let you go, all the talk next year will be about the five in a row. Do you see, who would you see in terms of the other counties that can compete with Dublin next year?
None of them.
Okay.
I think down the line, I'm hoping to see a strong Kildare team. Yeah. We will 100% see a strong Kerry team.
Yeah.
Tyrone might get a little bit stronger, but next year I think Dublin, the drive for five is safe. Maybe six might be a different story, but I think the bookies can pay out now.
Yeah, well, interesting times ahead, but your book kind of documents the time when Dublin weren't so great. It's a cracking read. Niall, thanks very much for joining us, and the best of luck with the book.
Thank you, thanks for having me on.
That's great. That was Niall Cotter who told us about his new book, Dublin, The Chaos Years. I'm just looking at the time. I'm totally out of time. So that's it for this evening. I'd like to thank my guest, Niall Cotter, for joining me today. Thank you for listening. And I'll talk to you at the same time next week. From then, enjoy your sporting week.